The Lesbian Gaze.
Lesben, die auf Lesben starren.
Oder der Podcast zu queer lesbischer Sichtbarkeit.
Mit Schnieke.
Und Julia. Herzlich willkommen zur 11. Folge der Lesbian Gaze. Es ist eine Jubiläumsfolge, denn unseren Podcast gibt es jetzt seit einem Jahr.
Yay! Schön, dass ihr da seid. Wir freuen uns sehr, dass ihr uns supportet. Und wir freuen uns sehr, heute Sadie Loon zu Gast zu haben.
Genau, denn unser heutiges Thema ist queere Sexarbeit und Queer Porn, als auch queere Sex Education. Und Sadie arbeitet seit über 20 Jahren in der queeren Sexarbeit und ist Teil der Sex School Hub, die sich mit queerer sexueller Aufklärung beschäftigt.
Sadie erzählt uns, warum sie queere Sex Education wichtig findet und wie sie das auch als queerer Elternteil mit ihren eigenen Kindern lebt. Außerdem sprechen wir über positive und negative Erfahrungen aus über 20 Jahren Sexarbeit und was sie vielleicht noch brauchen würde, um weiterhin gut arbeiten zu können und sich sicherer zu fühlen, als das vielleicht gerade manchmal möglich ist.
Und jetzt wünschen wir euch viel Spaß. Ausnahmsweise haben wir dieses Gespräch auf Englisch aufgenommen und ihr hört jetzt die nicht übersetzte Version. Wenn ihr es lieber auf Deutsch hören wollt, findet ihr noch eine zweite Version, die von Katrin Kempf übersetzt wurde. Viel Spaß bei der Folge.
Should we just get started? Do you have any questions or something you want to say up front?
No, actually I do have something I'd like to say up front, which is that in a way it's really nice to do this interview today because I just found out that one of the pioneers of the sex workers' rights movement in the United States, Margo St. James, died on the 11th, so 2 days ago. And she was a superpower force who basically got arrested on suspicion of prostitution when she was 25, although she wasn't a sex worker, and got convicted. And because of that, she became a sex worker because she saw how much the hypocrisy of and also misogyny was working within the legal system in the States. And she founded a lot of the first kind of organized sex worker rights movement organizations in the United States, and was someone who, when I was in my late teens and 20s and first learning about feminist sex positive sex workers, who in many ways are my conceptual legacy, she was someone that I read about with awe. And she was also one of the founders of the St. James Infirmary, which is a free occupational health and safety clinic in San Francisco for sex workers and their partners and children. And it's the only one like that in the world. And that's where I got all my health care for 10 years because I had no insurance, because the United States is a very backwards country in many ways. And so anyway, it's just like, it feels really nice to be talking about these issues kind of in memoriam to Margo.
That makes so much sense. Yeah. All right. Well, do you want to introduce yourself a little bit?
Sure. I'm Sadie Loon. I'm a sex worker and artist and a parent, and I'm an American. I've lived in Berlin for almost 8 years. I'm a femme queer non-binary person, and I've been a sex worker for 22 years in different parts of the industry, and I have two young kids.
Okay. We're so happy to have you here. It's great.
Thanks.
With everything that's going on.
Yeah, it's nice to have something that feels like very manageable work. Like talking on the phone on the couch in my pajamas is exactly the kind of gig that I'm up for right now. So I appreciate the opportunity.
On your website, you call yourself an artist, a performer, a lover, a whore. What do those terms mean to you, those labels?
Well, I feel like, you know, when I was little, it was my dream to become an artist. And that was something that got really, like, the path to feeling allowed to claim that title was really emotionally treacherous for me. But at this point in life, I'm 42 now, and it's clear that for about 20 years, I've been constantly working on projects, creative projects. And so in that way, I feel like my life is kind of inextricably connected with art. And I'm a performative person. I used to, like, I when I was a kid in school, my favorite thing to do as kind of like the little haven for my chronic depression was acting in plays. And then I learned about performance art in college. And mm-hmm. that's also where I learned about the work of Annie Sprinkle, who's one of my mm-hmm. friends and mentors. And I was like, oh my God, I want to move to San Francisco and become a performance artist. And then mm-hmm. I did that. And so I worked in performance art for quite a while, and I was also performing in plays. And then I started doing more and more work in porn, and specifically feminist, queer, and kind of weirdo, artsy porn. And so performance and on some level or another has been part of my life most of my life, mm-hmm. Whether it's in front of a live audience or on film. Mm-hmm. And Lover is like, I really feel very compelled to keep reorienting my life's work, how I spend my time, the focus of my kind of research and interests around mm-hmm. love. And that takes many, many different forms, but mm-hmm. It's something that feels like such a crucial and kind of almost increasingly, at least I feel like, okay, love may have always been challenging for society to enact in a general way. But the idea that love within partnerships or friendships or families was kind of the basis, or was clear that's what everyone was going for, at least, although there was often love lacking in those places mm-hmm. as far as the enactment of it, the performance of it. It was clear that everyone agreed, like, okay, this is what should be there, or what we all want. And I feel like even that idea is getting a bit challenged or jaded in the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years. And to me, it's, you know, it's the thing that is most clearly worth living for. It's mm-hmm. the thing that mm-hmm. I feel most committed to continuing to dive deeper and grow for and into. Mm-hmm. It's one of the reasons that I have children, because I wanted to know what that level of loving would be like in an experiential way. And I think it's really hard to experience that kind of like flavor of love without actually being a parent. And so, yeah, it's something that I feel very committed to exploring, investigating. Mm-hmm. And horror is, I've my whole adult life, I've worked in the sex industry. I really like the word horror. I feel mm-hmm. very kindred to it. I like to me, it's very empowering. I feel like it has a lot of historical weight, and also the weight of using it, like it's been very weaponized, mm-hmm. And still is. And, in so many languages, the translation of horror is still used very much as a weapon, even very far from meaning around sexuality or sex for pay. And so I really appreciate grounding it in its true meaning, which mm-hmm. is that I am someone who exchanges money and sometimes goods erotic experiences on many different levels, and that I feel entitled and empowered to claim that term as kind of a badge of my identity, and also one that clearly carries the weight of how much violence and oppression people in my position have faced in most cultures for centuries and centuries. So it's a term that isn't sanitized. It's not like trying to deny or completely put a positive spin on something. It feels very raw and real, and like all of that weight of the struggle of what it is to live in this world in a stigmatized profession is there, but it's also a salacious word. It's a sexy word. It's a word that people use when they're dirty talking. And there's a lot of civilian, like non-sex worker fantasy energy around the word for. And I feel like just the way that it encompasses all of these different points really suits me.
Yeah. I was just thinking, I love that. And I really like that you put like love so center in your work, on your website, because it's usually supposed to be separated. Like there's love and private, and then there's work and that's professional, no feelings, blah, blah, blah. So I love that you kind of are able to trespass that. That's really cool.
Thank you. I feel like for me, it's also a bit, it's a choice to present it that way, but it's a bit, it feels a bit out of my control to live that way. Like I'm not a person who has ever functioned properly in the normative hegemonic world. And so like the way that love is kind of central to my my ability to keep going in this lifetime is, it doesn't feel really avoidable. I could de-emphasize that, but honestly, that's so much the basis of how and why and what makes me able to work as well.
Yeah, totally makes sense. So I think I first landed on your Instagram page via the Sex School Hub. Can you tell us a bit about your work with them and what's the project all about?
Sure. Sex School Hub is a website that is a project with different writing, but primarily focused on fairly short video clips that some are explicit and some are not. But the idea is to basically fill in a lot of the sex education that was not available in school or other kind of traditional ways that we got our what's the word I'm looking for? What's Unterricht? Education, exactly. Whatever. in whatever institutional ways or also familial ways that most people are talking about sex as younger people, I would say it's still more rare than common that people are taught lessons that include the emotional aspects, the social aspects, the pleasure as central to the experience, ideas around how to navigate tricky social or emotional territory, and also lessons that come from a queer-centric perspective.
Yeah.
So something that doesn't start with heteronormativity as the default, and then maybe yes, maybe no, kind of add some gay like asterisk possibility, but starts with this should feel comfortable and relatable to any person with any kind of body, with any kind of sexuality, as far as the words that are being spoken, at least, and as far as the the assumptions made around bodies, feelings, desires, etc. Mm. And you can translate that through your own experience and desires fairly fluidly. And so, and then also the fact that it's specifically working to be educational while also sexually explicit. Mm-hmm. So there's no kind of like dot, dot, dot moment where it's mm-hmm. like, and then you have to kind of like imagine what it might look like. It's, yeah. It's the actual sex is there.
Mm-hmm.
When talking about sexual issues, and that also the presenters, the four main educators are all sex workers. They're all people who have porn performance experience. At least some of us are do other kinds of work in the sex industry as well. And so I really appreciate how, you know, not all sex workers are comfortable being educators, and not mm-hmm. all sex work needs to be educational, but to mm-hmm. but to say that people who have gone to school for, you know, 3 to 4 years, maybe more, are always going to be more informed and better presenters of knowledge mm-hmm. about sexuality than people who may have been having experiential learning for decades
mm.
doesn't really make sense. So I really appreciate the kind of like elevating, and in a non-assumptive way, of just like, of course sex workers can have some very interesting, well-informed things to say about this mm-hmm. and can be sources, good sources of knowledge. Because honestly, oftentimes this is part of what people go to sex workers for.
Yeah.
Is to learn.
Yeah. Mm. Totally makes sense.
Yeah. We both listened to an episode of the podcast, Wash Your Mouth Out, and you were talking about being a parent. And so mm-hmm. we asked ourselves, you know, what role does sex education play in parenting for you?
I think it's very, I think most of the things that I focus on in my parenting as far as specific themes or topics that mm-hmm. are, yeah, non-normative or not in the mainstream or not what I felt of or got from my parents, mm-hmm. Like, for instance, anti-racism, queerness, sexuality, et cetera, I think most of that, the way that I handle it is that it's really just woven in the fabric of normalcy. I'm putting air quotes around normalcy, but in basically in regular days, it's something, the way that I approach it is mostly, it's not as much about picking out specific things or specific moments or specific media to be like, we need to have a big talk about this, but more that I don't leave out all of the knowledge and the richness and the experience when they come up naturally through, you know, when we're walking to Kita and there's a giant billboard, you know, advertising something. Like I remember one time I was taking one of my kids to Kita and mm-hmm. there was a billboard for Venus, Expo. Mm-hmm. And it's a big mainstream, kind of porn and sex industry, Expo that happens mm-hmm. every year mm-hmm. in Berlin. And the billboards always have like several almost nude, usually very similar looking, usually very blonde women.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the kind of billboard that I think probably isn't even like legal in the United States. Because they're so naked. But
true. Yeah.
But anyway, you know, if my kid kind of notices this or I point this out and be like, oh, look at this. And then, you know, we have a little conversation about that. Mm-hmm. And it's not to say that I don't also provide books or other materials for my kids to kind of support our talking, but it's more like just clearly laying the groundwork, like I do with my friendships, around that, yeah, sexuality is part of our world and our bodies. And of course, you do it at the level, the developmental level that is appropriate for the kids. And so, I mean, like the very first step was just teaching the kid that I have that has a vulva, that vulva was the name for the genitals. Yeah, and also like providing them with a mirror and being like, let me point out, like, okay, that's the vulva. Do you see that part? That's the labia. That's the urethra where your pee comes out. You know, here's a clitoris. Also, there's a part inside. And just like giving her range to explore and ask questions and watching my tone that I don't as much as possible inadvertently with my body language or my tone of voice present anything in a shameful way or in a this isn't okay to be discussed. And I do the same with my kid that has like penis and testicle genitals. It's like, it's like, oh, there's your penis. Oh, you know, like one thing that I've learned is that babies with penises start getting erections really early. And being like, oh, yep, look, it's big and hard. Cool. you know, this is your penis. This is your testicles. No, I have a vulva. We talk, you know, like there's a certain point in early toddlerdom when kids most like usually become pretty interested in babies and they just like the idea of babies and where are the babies and how do you have babies? They want to talk about babies. And so, you know, there's this great book that's a queer-centric book called How Babies Are Made. It basically breaks it down anatomically, but also kind of narratively of like, you know, you need a body that has an egg and a body that has a sperm. And then you need a body that has a uterus, and not all bodies have sperm, and not all bodies have eggs, and not all bodies have uteruses, but blah, 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 things like that. And so, yeah, like grounding it within their own bodies, because of course, kids are naturally curious and interested, and then building from there. And I think that most of it is about just having information or media or resources available that don't bypass the topics. So that's what we do.
Yeah. It's cool that you get like queer-centric books nowadays. Or maybe you always did get them, but I never, no. I never saw any of it.
No. I mean, frankly, and most of the resources that I know come from the US. But no, I really don't think there were queer-centric books for the most part, especially not for kids. I think this is really a fairly recent historical development, and I feel very lucky and privileged to be living in this time frame where it's not, because it does something in a dynamic with kids when they start to get the idea that their parents are kind of the only ones who talk this way or have these ideas or have a certain belief system or whatever. And it's really, really helpful to have other people and also support materials that kind of frame the belief system within a wider framework.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Do you sometimes get shit or like dirty looks from other parents that you
not yet, do this differently? Not yet, but my kids are young. And frankly, for the most part, it doesn't come up that much with other parents. Also, you know, I live in Neukölln in Berlin. Mm-hmm. And while most parents that I know are not queer and mm-hmm. not sex workers, there's enough kind of like latent sex positive, some sort of feminism, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I mean, thankfully I'm not living in a, extremely conservative ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, I think, and also because there are people from so many different countries and cultural backgrounds, there's a lot mm-hmm. of kind of flexibility thus far in kind of like, oh, you do your way, we do our way, you do that way.
Yeah.
And but also it just doesn't come up that much yet because like my kids aren't really, I don't think they're talking so much about this with their peers. It's more like they're just absorbing for themselves.
All right. Because I feel like that's a fear that you sometimes get, that like, you know, you have to shame these topics because kids will like blurt it out or something. But
I think maybe that's the case. I think the more I want a better word than normal. I think the more ordinary it mm-hmm. is to learn and discuss this regularly over years, the less they want to blurt it out because it's not some exceptional piece of forbidden knowledge. I think my older kid, it's really, they clearly have the sense that, okay, there's the queer world and then there's the other world, like school and stuff. And they know that it's not, once we were, for instance, painting Easter eggs, and I painted, I think her name is Balbo, this goddess of laughter and mirth, like a small ancient Greek goddess that's basically a big laughing vulva on legs. And I painted it on one of the eggs. Mm-hmm. And my kid was like, yeah, that can be, that maybe one of the queer people will find that one. And I was like, oh, why do you say that? And they were like, well, queer people like vulvas more than other people. And I was like, and they were like five. And I was like, okay, this is your worldview to this point. This is what you've gotten. And I'm not going to argue with it.
Yeah.
But, so it's not that they have no sense of difference between kind of like our home world and home culture and all of this, but I don't think they know exactly where the points of extreme exceptionality are because those things have not been taboo to them. And so they don't know that it's like, hey, guess what, guys? I learned this word and what this does, you know what I mean? Like, it's not like when my kid wants to troll me, they're not talking about like whatever the sex things, they're talking about how all people with blue eyes are related, and that means that I'm related to Donald Trump, and like. That's like their favorite thing to say, to be like, did you know, mama? And I'm yes, you've told me many times before. Thank you.
Coming back to your work. So you've mentioned that you've been doing sex work for 22 years, I believe. Mm-hmm. How do you experience like the queer sex work?
You mean sex work where the clients are not cis men?
Yeah.
Is that what you mean? Okay. I mean, what I would say is in the last few years, most of my session work, so like one-on-one sessions with clients that are around either BDSM or fucking, have been with women and occasionally like non-cis women, other queer people, trans folks and etc., non-binary people. And that has been really great because mm-hmm. the pay isn't as high, but the the job satisfaction is quite high for me. Mm-hmm. And it just fulfills a bit of a fantasy from my younger self that, mm-hmm. you know, like the more that I became politicized and the more that I, had like consciousness around how much systems of oppressions kind of affect every dynamic between people in the world, the more I had this kind of conflict about, okay, well, if I'm, if my clientele is all rich, mostly white, not all, but mostly white, rich, cis men, you know, if part of my mission statement, which again, this is not at all true for all sex workers, I'm just talking for myself, but if part of my mission statement is some kind of like spiritual belief in facilitating and spreading pleasure as like a general energetic force of good in the world, and as well as something that I really believe can, let's think of it in kind of basic terms, like generally reduces stress, that will then, you know, have a more positive impact on the spouse, family, kids, coworkers, friends, etc. of the client, like a kind of like an energetic trickle down effect. That I felt very conflicted that, okay, but as usual, the people who have access to this service are, you know, the people at the top of the white supremacist patriarchal power pyramid. And while in a very kind of like humanist way, I believe, okay, well, these people need and deserve to have access to pleasure and all of these things as well. The framing of it was, this is when I got also more into understanding prostitution from a labor rights perspective, where like it doesn't have to be always some spiritual connection force of light between you and the client. It can also just be a job, but the point is, you know, in most jobs, the people at the top are white cis men, the people who have all the money and the access and such. So, but since I started working more and more with women clients and other queer people as clients, I really get a lot of deep satisfaction from providing my services, especially after all of these years of experience, to people that are much closer to my community. And I also think it really speaks for a cultural shift that more people, more women feel entitled to seek out sex workers for themselves. Yeah, that's like true. That's a huge thing, because even if you take money out of it, it's really just not where the culture allows non-cis males to imagine themselves, you know, like there's like no matter what your personal opinion is on sex work, there's definitely centuries of like rich historical conceptual space for men see whores, you know, and maybe you are or are not, quote, that type of guy. And maybe you would never do that. Or maybe you would say one thing and secretly have your own life where you do many things. But the fact is that like the world does not have to stretch its imagination to think about cis men going to see prostitutes. And I think for people who are not cis male identified, this is a really kind of new conceptual landscape that talks about a lot about kind of like entitlement, about privilege, about access to pleasure and prioritizing that in their own lives. And I think this is extremely powerful shifts going on.
And I
also think that the more widespread proliferation of queer porn is one of the ingredients that's allowed that to happen. Mm. Like, I think queer porn is one of the ways in which it's shown that queer sex work can both be existing in kind of like it's generally presented in a positive context, mm-hmm. and also still quite pleasurable. I think a lot of women, the first thought is, I can't afford that. The second thought is, oh, I just can't do that. And the third thought is, oh, I don't want to exploit anybody. And and I think that something about the visual continuance of queer porn, where queer folks are making a product for other people to enjoy, and there's clearly a monetary exchange in there somewhere, although not always, but that's the assumption. And then you can also see how much people can enjoy having sex for the camera under like in this framework of exchange. I think that is helping people come to terms in their minds with, oh, and maybe that could also be for me.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm allowed to imagine this for myself as well.
Yeah. And kind of break this like automatic association with exploitation, etc.
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
You moved to Berlin a couple of years ago. How would you say did it change the way you can do your work and maybe be even freer to choose your clients? Is there any, would you say there's a connection to it, how you can do your work?
No, I would not say that it's freer about how I choose my clients at all. I've always been, I mean, the thing is, I am not a good business person. So I've always been an under earner as a sex worker, but that also means that tend to be pretty, pretty lucky with having mostly clients that are pretty good fits for me, for the majority of my work. And that I have spent very little time in my sex work career being a high quantity, like high traffic, sex worker. And so it's honestly, sex work has supported me to stay broke for most of my life with the time and energy available to do art, creative work, some amount of activism, and to manage my mental health condition in a way that I can't imagine any other kind of job allowing. And so, and because of like the privileges that have nothing to do with me, like I'm somewhere between like that I'm non-binary, but also not completely uncomfortable with cis projection or presentation, that I'm femme, that I'm white, that I'm not fat, that I was well educated thanks to my parents and things like that, I was able to work in such a way that my work didn't take that much of my time. And I was usually pretty unwilling to meet clients that set off red flags. Of course, like in sex work, the red flag-o-meter is something that you gets more honed over time. And I mean, I've been working for many years, so depending on the moment in my personal history, I've done it different ways. But the thing is, I was for the most part, I mean, I started as a stripper and then I went and I worked in a massage parlor and then I started working for an escort agency. And then I moved to San Francisco and became an independent escort. And I worked independently, but at a dungeon doing BDSM sessions and then also sometimes porn shoots. And basically, since becoming independent, so since I was like 23, I've had a lot of agency over which clients I see and how, and when and what my own personal boundaries are. I've made less money because of some of those boundaries. But for instance, I've always had a policy that I only give blowjobs with condoms. And that when I was starting working in San Francisco, that wasn't standard practice, but it was important to me because I didn't have health insurance, for instance, you know? And so there were certain, definitely some percentage of clients that were like, no, that's, I'm not into that. I'm not going to pay, you know, for that. But it wasn't all of them, you know? And I think I'm a person who, as a sex worker, it's really my kind of like personality and energy and then my experience and then my looks that tends to draw people in. I'm not like that body centric. And I think that's one misconception a lot of people have about sex workers in general is that it's like all about the body. And some people that's their market. That's their business model is, you know, like it's really about selling to people who specifically are interested in, you know, specific body parts, specific body types, a specific genre type, et cetera. But like, I don't really have an exceptional body in any particular way and never really have. And so most of my clients, I think, have always been interested in kind of like a fuller experience than, and that's what I've also marketed to. Now, I can't remember something about queer sex work. Oh yeah. Do I feel freer in Berlin? So since I stopped working at the strip club, most of my work is illegal in the States. So I've been an illegal worker for most of my life. And now that you are supposed to be registered here in Germany, I'm still an illegal worker in that sense. While prostitution is legal here, it's, you know, with this registration thing, I'm not registered. So I don't know that it's done anything more freeing. I would just say that when I started living here, the rates and the general rates for prostitution sessions were so low compared to San Francisco, where I moved from, that I never really developed the same kind of business model that I had been working before. Like I never really developed in Berlin a clientele of cis men where I was really trying to like work that market. And maybe the freedom was not about anything particularly like about a law or an attitude of Berlin, but mostly just that I kind of didn't feel like it was worth my while. Like I would have had to hustle way harder, also potentially in another language, which I didn't know at first. And that felt really dangerous to me, for a kind of clientele, which maybe also wasn't as interested in what I had to offer in this kind of well-rounded package. Now, I think things have changed here. I think with the cost of living going up and the more kind of like rich expats come here, I know English-speaking, like English-speaking-based hoes who do really good business here, make bank, etc. But when I moved here, everyone I knew that was not happening and that didn't really seem possible. And, and I think maybe that also kind of allowed me to focus my work energy more in porn and then, in women clients, which again is not that profitable, but it, at least then I'm getting the job satisfaction. Like job satisfaction is always important to me. Yeah. I always want to see someone leaving with a big smile on their face and feeling better than when they got there. But there's something that's like deep soul ancestor pleasing healing work that it feels like to fuck women for money. and so, yes, so I feel really lucky and privileged. And, you know, a price cut, a pay cut is understandable based on the pay differential between, you know, cis men and non-cis men in the world. And also, it's worth it.
I already mentioned your Instagram that I really enjoy. What role does social media play for you?
Oh, that's interesting. I think, you know, I didn't get into social media until maybe 4 years ago. So I never had a Facebook until about 4 years ago. I didn't have a smartphone. I think I've been on Twitter for 10 years, but it's like probably for most of those years, I've posted like one tweet every 3 months or something like that. I started on social media, things that you won't know, a thing like a site called Friendster that doesn't exist anymore. And then a site called Tribe that doesn't exist anymore. This is all when I was like 23 to 25, probably living in San Francisco. And basically by the time MySpace came around, I was out. And so I never had a MySpace, didn't have Facebook, et cetera, because I couldn't deal with it emotionally. My mental health couldn't deal with it. And I also am just kind of logistic. I'm not super tech savvy. And I have a very frustrating personal dynamic with technology. And so for many years, I was just like, I can't deal with this. It's also this whole aspect of my life that doesn't really make sense to me. This was also like before smartphones. So I just kind of avoided as much as possible. And then, yeah, about 4 years ago, I was like, I mean, for the last, I don't know, 8 or so years, it was becoming increasingly apparent that my work was really suffering for lack of social media presence. And I don't just mean my sex work, but my artwork, but like whatever, like to me, it's a really blurry spectrum between kind of like art and sex work. And there are certain things like doing sessions with clients for the most part, I'm like, okay, that's just sex work. And there are certain things that are just artworks, but there's a lot of the work that I do that's kind of like hazily in between these two poles. And basically it was clear to me that I was not getting seen or offered or thought of for the kind of gigs that I wanted to, that a lot of my peers and colleagues were because of my lack of social media presence. And my ex, who is a millennial, helped me set this up. And for some reason, which is super, super ironically shitty, Instagram is the platform that like really works with my brain and what I'm feel able to handle. Because another thing is just doing anything consistently is really hard for me, like in general in life. Anything that's consistent or every day, I'm not easy to pick up with daily habits. But especially if I feel like there's pressure of like, oh, my business depends on it, or my fans are expecting this, like that immediately makes me feel paralyzed. And I'm like, nope, not happening. So for whatever reason, I think part of it was also my development, especially like through the years of that relationship, towards just better self-esteem, but also better creative and professional self-esteem, because I started to really realize that no matter what my own opinion of my work was, I'd been doing it a fucking long time relatively to everyone else I knew. And that meant something, you know, that's something that can't be, you can't shortcut that. And so And also, like, this relationship really helped me. Like, the reflection I got from the outside was really positive with my ex. And so that helped me internalize some things more and be like, ah, okay. And I'd get a little bit of distance to, like, the 12 or 15 years before of, like, unbearable, shameful embarrassment about trying to not draw attention to myself, because that's always come very naturally to me, but to, but to, like, put my work out there as in, like, you should care, or let me, you know, like, here's some more about me. Because I mean, when I started doing art and sex work publicly, this was not a way, you know, like, if you're going into some professional field now and you don't have social media and you're not self-promoting, that's weird. But when I started, it was like, people were still on email. They were just starting to send text messages regularly. All of this, like, here's some more pictures I took of myself, and don't you want to hear about my big project? That was fucking annoying, you know?
And
it
was,
there was a lot of resistance to becoming one of those people at the beginning. And people who had, you know, self-worth or low self-esteem problems with creative work or professional work like I did, it was a lot of resistance. And for me now, I'm not so psychologically entwined with, you know, like, what social media means about my deep humanity, or, like, how much I'm bothering people or whatever anymore. And part of that's because it's evolved to where it is now. And part of it's just because I've personally gotten over that and can be like, okay, this is the thing that I do to support my work and where I want to go, to honor the work that I've done. And it helps people, because also I used to honestly think that the work that I did was somehow kept in, like, a public archive of memory. And it took me some years to get to the point of realizing that people are mostly creating new things from the ideas or the faces or the people that have been right in front of their face most recently. And that nobody knew or remembered that, okay, in 2005, I did such and such, such and such, and such and such. And then 2006, do you know what I mean? Like, that's just not how it works.
You have to build your own archive, kind of.
Yeah.
You have to build your own archive. So I'm finally starting to get around to that. You said something about Instagram. I don't remember. Oh, no. The other thing is, that's great, though, that I really appreciate about Instagram as not as a platform, because as a platform, they're incredibly whorephobic. They hate queers, sex workers, fat people, disabled people, and they punish us. And I'm frankly incredibly surprised that I haven't lost this account from their new terms of service. And basically, every time I open my phone and go to check Instagram, I'm bracing myself for the moment when it's just disappeared. As far as just the way that it functions, though, one thing that's been really great for me is I've gotten clients through Instagram that are, like, for instance, very young queers that are, like, traveling from other places to Berlin and have, like, saved up their pennies to, like, go have an experience. And they choose to share that with me, which is, like, such a beautiful honor. Or, you know, couples from the club scene who have seen my Instagram, or just very non-traditional client types, or other sex workers. I've had other sex workers contact me and are like, hey, I'd like a session. And that's really beautiful, not to mention people flirting with me and also getting art gigs. So like recently, a young queer person from Paris, this just happened in the last couple of days, wrote and was like, hey, we're doing this Instagram profile as a gallery where we're mixing the work of artists and the work of sex workers as they present on their own Instagram. And we'd like to, feature you in this. Yeah. And these kinds of offers come fairly regularly, which is just, like, as well as having the best contact with the general worldwide global sex worker rights community, as well as specific sex workers that I'm like colleague friends with, where that's our main point of solidarity and connection. And there's just a lot of like very rich sex work, as well as queer, as well as so many marginalized population culture happening on Instagram. And when we get suddenly deleted, it's, you know, it's cutting a lot off in a way that I'm surprised for myself I would ever feel so invested with as far as social media, since I was always a hater. I've been a lifelong hater. However, oh, I have something else to say about that though. However, it is also brutal. I find that one thing that I have come to learn only in the last couple of years, like personally, is that virtual space is real space. Virtual space is real public space. And the way that we are engaged with virtual space in this time is very much like the way that people used to engage with like the Dyke Bar or the art gallery or whatever literal physical space that was specifically made by and for and curated, you know, for the like specific small communities, marginalized communities. And that, however, unlike those physical spaces, it's always open. It's always new. And the algorithms are specifically designed to mimic gambling machines, so that they like they're specifically designed to be both addictive, and then the it's kind of like a side effect, but also part of the functionality of that is to help us feel less than, is to really trigger our insecurity. And whatever points, whatever the story, you know, whatever our top three stories that we have about ourselves, about what's wrong with us or what our problem is, or, you know, what's not good enough or what we don't do enough of, these platforms are designed to trigger those points and to then track, but in such a way that we will then want to engage to, and to get the hits of, you know, what happens when we get likes or we get messages or et cetera. And I think that for someone, I think for anyone, that can be really hardcore, and that you know, the first, I don't know, decade, 15 years of people using social media regularly, there was a lot of kind of like denial of that, or pretending like that wasn't true. And I think it's becoming more of a just known truth now that social media can do great things, and it can also really deplete the soul. And but also within a community, within queer community, within sex work community, and specifically within queer porn, I find it often really brutal. And for myself, and one thing I was going to say before, also when you were asking about how is queer sex work, so the sessions are one thing, and porn is a very different thing. And porn to me has a lot more, it costs a lot more. It costs me a lot more. And I feel, I love doing the shoots. I love the container to work with other performers in a safe and intimate way, but that the professionalism of it allows things to be very intimate and close in that moment, if mm-hmm. they can be, and then also without without having to really discuss, like, okay, what does this mean for us after? Like, it's clear that it's like within this container. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate that. I love the artistry that's happening mm-hmm. in my porn world now. I really, really like doing the shoots. I like making this visual archive. I feel really honored to be part of this visual archive mm-hmm. of queer creativity and sexual expression mm-hmm. from these decades that I've been active in it. And on the other hand, it is really challenging. Mm-hmm. The social aspect, the competition, which is not explicit but very implicit, mm. the crossover between dating, love, romance, social, colleague, professional, friendship worlds is mm. brutal. And mm-hmm. And it's really, really, really tricky to navigate. And after all of these years, for many years, I thought it was kind of just me, that I was the only one who was sensitive enough to like have issues with this. And I mm-hmm. really realized at this point that it's just very, very intense. It's mm-hmm. very intense to have your creative world and your sexual world and your public world and your dating and partnership world and your friendships all be the same small world that's mm-hmm. also up for public viewing by mm-hmm. everybody else in that world. It's mm-hmm. so intense, and it's such a lot to hold and mm-hmm. to navigate. And there's so many times when, for me, it's really felt like it's really, really amped up my feelings of insecurity or not mm-hmm. good enough or not hot enough or not loved enough or whatever. Mm-hmm. For some reason, the publicness of this plus the fact that the audience and the performers and directors are often an overlapping, fairly small kind of same community in mm-hmm. a way that even most of my women clients are not as close. Just the lack of boundaries or safe spaces or distance is really, really intense. And mm-hmm. I don't think I'm the only one that feels that. And I think the longer time you spend in it, or the more that, for instance, you have lovers or partners who also work in the industry, or however many levels of yourself and your emotional needs from other people overlap within that community, the harder it can be. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of, especially young queers, are like, oh my God, I'm going to make a bunch of porn with all my friends and it's going to be awesome and empowering and whatever. And that can be totally true. And also it can be so full of heartbreak and lost friendships and broken relationships and broken self-esteem in ways that I think are really challenging for people to imagine or foresee. And I think that we're not that as a community, I don't think we're that open about yet. Okay. And I think that's something to consider.
Mm-hmm.
Which, like, usually if you're doing like one or two projects, maybe that can be avoided,
mm-hmm.
you know, mm-hmm. but the longer you're in it, and the longer, whether you want to or not, or whether you admit to yourself or not, but the longer your self-esteem and your sense of self and the way that you value yourself is related to it,
mm.
the trickier and more challenging it can be.
Hmm. Thank you for sharing. That's definitely something that we don't talk about a lot, but that's really important.
No, and I think it's just the nature of just not having enough space in between worlds, you know? Like if you have, if something goes wrong on a project, that might mean that you're having a crisis with a friendship or two. It might mean that then the greater community has a split because of the stories or whoever they're closer to within that set. It might mean that, someone that you've been dating doesn't agree with you about the work thing or wants that to continue. And then that's a crisis within your personal life, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, people need to be able to like come home and be free of queer drama if possible. And it becomes really difficult the more entangled or interconnected or overlapping, you know, these scenes and the way we act with them are. And then also you'll get someone you don't even know coming up to you, usually at the worst emotional moment when you're like having some sort of breakdown about something about work, being like, oh my God, I saw your cut on screen, this blah blah blah, blah and this, you can't expect when that's going to happen or what the people are going to say. And it's often in the moment when you're having total professional doubt breakdown or some sort of personal emotional thing relating to that work. And then you're like, oh, Jesus Christ. Wow. And everyone in this neighborhood has seen my pussy, you know, 12 meters tall. Fuck.
Yeah.
Or parents of the other kids at your kid's Kita, which has happened to me. You know, and that's just out of your control. Like, it's not even so much about the internet, although of course that as a public sphere and who we follow and who follows us and what people are commenting and who's working with us is all much more kind of like unpredictable and like urgent and always present on the internet. But it's also can be, you know, the day that you have your period and you haven't had a shower for 4 days and it's the middle of winter in Berlin and you feel like hell and you're kind of depressive and you just got a professional disappointment. And then some dude comes up to you on the U-Bahn and is like, hey, I saw you at the festival, blah, 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 blah. It's intense. It's really intense. So just a little warning to the... the young, sexy, slutty queers with stars in their eyes. And also maybe a little bit of emotional backup. I mean, maybe truly it is only me that I am the most sensitive queer porn performer in the world. Possibly that's true. But I do know that other performers have had at least their own issues within the scene. Whether and the way that professional and personal relationships overlap, it can be tricky, and I'll just leave it at that.
Before we were talking about obstacles you're facing that may be specific to sex work, like shadow banning on Instagram or legal issues, so what would you say are you missing in order to work well, to feel seen, to feel safe in your work?
Decriminalization of prostitution and all forms of in-person sex work where it's not the government's job to regulate, but comes from within the sex industry by sex workers. Online platforms, fucking, it's like, you know, the same old shitty cocktail of patriarchy, white supremacy, capitalism, conservatism, but mostly it's about control. Like, I don't even really think it's about morals at this point. It's just about control and monetization and appeasing the elite. And basically, the elite wants sex work available only to them.
and they want to be able to decide the terms on who it's for, what they get to look like, how they act in dynamic with them. And they want, you know, that to be, it's like the Catholic Church. Everything's taboo. Well, except if, you know, you say enough Hail Marys or whatever, whatever. And if you're, and if you're a priest, you know, it's, you get some allowances. And I think that, you know, the internet used to be the free frontier, and now I can do less online without losing my platform, my account, than I can do at a craft market, that I can do in a performance art publicly in the middle of the street. You know, I won't be arrested in Berlin for showing my ass on an U-Bahn platform in the middle of a guerrilla performance art, as long as I have a permit that I'm allowed to perform on the U-Bahn platform. I know this from personal experience. And thank you to that German queer who got me that fucking permit. However, I can't go, you know, I got scolded by Instagram for posting a picture of a postcard that a friend had sent me from Greece that had, it was just two asses covered with sand, and it said, like, wish you were here, like a really cheesy postcard, you know, that's probably they have in like Mexico, the Caribbean, Spain, Turkey, anywhere where there's a beach. You know, these same two sandy asses are all over the world. And if you think about it, these asses are on postcard stands where children and elderly people and religious people all buy their tourist shit. And they're all confronted with these asses, and somehow the world keeps going. And yet on Instagram, you are not allowed to show this postcard. It is removed for terms of service. So more freedom. You know, I don't need the whole world to agree with what I do or like it or believe in it, but I do need them to understand that as a human doing work, I should be entitled to safety within my workplace, that I should be entitled to healthcare, that I should be entitled to set the terms of my own working conditions in such a way that make them, safer and more comfortable, like everyone. And that includes being able to work with my colleagues in the same space. That includes being able to have online spaces where my colleagues and I can meet and discuss and, you know, talk about who's safe, who's not safe, how we can organize with each other's to like improve our work situation, et cetera. I mean, I pretty much mostly need for the whole white supremacist, patriarchal, queer, trans, disabled, fat phobic world to kind of like cut that shit out if I really want to feel safe and comfortable. Because the problem is that even if you're living in the most privileged body, you can't guarantee that forever. You know, bodies change and they age. And no matter what your race is, no matter what your ability level is, no matter what size you are, that can change at any moment. And who is benefiting or gets to call the terms of what the losers get or are restricted to can change at any moment when you live in such a hierarchy. And in order to feel really safe and comfortable, that's just not happening anymore. Not only are sex workers not killed, and that's seen as like a price of the stigma of what sex work is about, but women aren't killed. Women aren't killed by their partners or their exes. You know, women aren't killed by the state. People of color aren't shot by police and military. like, yeah, will I ever get to feel safe and comfortable working or not in this world? Probably not on a bone deep level. But I really, really value and cherish the little bubble worlds that I can create where I do when that happens, where and when that happens.
You gave some recommendations on getting into porn as like a performer or an artist. Is there something you would recommend or something to look out for people who want to get into porn as a consumer? Like, what are the things to look out for if you want to get like ethical porn?
It depends what you're into. I mean, the number one platform that I always recommend, and they're my most beloved and favorite place to direct people who are maybe looking for a variety of pornographies that are not what is coming up right away on Pornhamster or XTube or whatever the hell, is to go to pinklabel.tv. They're my favorite. They're a queer BIPOC owned and operated platform that is started by Shine Louise Houston, who is the director and producer of Crash Pad series, not to mention a bunch of other works. And it has things you can't find anywhere else. It has things that have only been shown in festivals that don't exist on the internet anywhere else. Things probably that haven't even been in festivals. So there's a lot of range there. There's a lot of uniqueness, but it's also a platform designed specifically to uplift, co-support, and do financial solidarity with small porn directors and producers that somehow either identify as or work within a conceptual framework of feminism, queerness, anti-racism, and sex positivity. So you can see things like Crash Pad series. It's been running for probably around 12 years now, maybe longer, maybe more like 14. You can see now there's more and more work from outside of the US, from Europe. There's a big crossover there. And also from, I think they're having work now from South America and other countries. And it's just it's very varied, the kind of work there. There's kind of like formulaic. It's just a scene. It's people fucking. There's like whole narrative fleshed out movies, but that also have explicit content. There's fetish stuff that maybe there's no genitals at all, but like, you know, is made from the perspective of a leather fetishist or a foot fetishist or a hair fetishist or whatever. So there's a lot of very interesting, artistic, creative, weird, raw, beautiful, hot work there that also, I just think the variety and the support for performers and makers, that you don't have to be prolific. You don't have to be the most productive director or producer or performer, but you still have a chance to earn some side cash through this platform. It's amazing. So for aesthetic, variety, and political reasons, that's my top pick. And then I feel like from there, you can also find a lot of other directors and platforms that maybe you like. And like, for instance, a friend of mine, Jennifer Lyon Bell, just started her own platform. She is a white American woman who lives in the Netherlands, and she makes sweet, sexy porn that often focuses on moments of like kind of tense awkwardness. She really likes that. And her studio is called Blue Artichoke. Mm-hmm. And they have their own platform now. Also in Australia, oh, I forgot to say Australia, Ms. Naughty has a platform, Bright Desire, that also has some other people's work, but a lot of Bright Desire stuff that's kind of all within a similar conceptual vein. Mm-hmm. So I'd say start on Pink Label. Mm-hmm. And I must say, I'm mostly talking about, frankly, people that I like personally, but also there aren't that many platforms, and most of them cross over with Pink Label.
Okay. All right. What are projects you're working on at the moment, and where can people find you and support you?
Oh, that's nice of you to ask. Right now, I'm mostly working on kind of surviving day by day with two kids during a pandemic and trying to be very careful about doing what I can to support my mental health. So my focus is really not in production or achievement in this bigger way, but I do have an OnlyFans. I have OnlyFans, Instagram, Twitter. My name is Sadie Loon on all of these things. On Instagram, it's Sadie_Loon because my initial Sadie Loon got deleted. And I have a website, SadieLoon.com, that also has other things. I'm still working with a sex school hub, and I wrote and directed and performed in a new little mini educational piece for them that will come out in March. I've been doing a series of photo shoots, and I have some other more visual products in the work. I did do a eco-sexual BDSM porn with a young performer named Almond in the woods, and so that film should be out next year. And you can check out my website to see more things. But yeah, I mean, it's a slow time as far as gigs, shoots, performances, etc. And I'm just trying to find ways to engage creatively that feed me enough that I can go on mostly doing care work and kind of like treading water for another month or so. And for the most part, the things that have been the most easy to access, considering the children and restrictions and my energy these days, have been photo shoots, but working on visual art again as well. I feel like there's more things. I've probably done writing recently. Oh, a piece that I wrote will be coming out in a book called Transsex. That's it's basically a manual for professionals who work somehow around sexuality with trans clientele, whether that's like doctors, therapists, sex workers, et cetera, that's trying to help practitioners work with their trans clients better. And so I have a piece appearing in that. That'll be coming out this year, Transsex. Oh, that's all I can think of right now.
Nice. Of course, we will link all the stuff in this episode and on our Instagram so people can find you.
Cool, thanks.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
That was amazing. Thank you.
Wir hoffen, euch hat die Folge gefallen. Nochmal ein großes Dankeschön an Sadie und an Katrin für die Übersetzung. Wie versprochen, verlinken wir euch natürlich alles in den Shownotes und ihr findet alles weitere auch auf Instagram.
Viel Spaß beim Pornschauen. Falls ihr Fragen oder Feedback für uns habt, schreibt uns gerne jederzeit entweder per Mail bei thelesbiangays.podcast@gmail.com oder folgt uns auf Instagram und schreibt uns auf Instagram. Da sind wir @thelesbiangays.pod. Und ansonsten bis zum nächsten Mal.
Tschüss!